Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with Mike Croissant, whose incredible new book, Bombing Hitler's Hometown, is the culmination of over a decade's worth of research and interviews with dozens of men who flew that fateful mission over Linz, Austria in late April 1945. In a moment, we're going to hear the memories of one of those men, as heard on this program way back in 2010. But first, Mike, I want to ask you about one of those men on that mission who you never had the chance to interview because he died shortly after returning from overseas in World War II. I'm talking about your uncle, Ellsworth Croissant. How much did you really know about your uncle when you were growing up?
My dad and he were 12 or 13 months apart in birth order. And they were very close. And I know that my uncle's death devastated him. My dad was quiet to begin with, and he never really talked about it. But throughout my life, I have distinct memories of my dad having a little lockbox. And every now and then, and in hindsight, it was probably the anniversary of my uncle's death. I don't know for sure, but he would get out this lockbox, and he would be looking through newspaper clippings about my uncle, and as well as his photos. And like I said, he was quiet anyway, but he seemed deeply saddened, and that made me sad. And luckily, not long before my dad passed away, I got him to talk a little about it. I took what information I had and did some research, and I was able to locate a report that I purchased and studied about the accident that killed my uncle. And I was able to hopefully give the family some peace of mind, because the answers that the Army gave at the time were inadequate. They essentially didn't really understand why he had been taken from them at such a young age. So I did that, and that just left me wanting to do more. And that led me to this story. And Paul, I have to pause here and thank you, because you are one of the men who led me down this path. I mean, I was looking into one of the men on the mission, Dale Shabilsky. And in my search on the internet, I found the show where you interviewed him. And it was a very touching story. And I thank you for that. Between Dale's story, my uncle's story, and a couple of other crews that we could talk about, it quickly became for me not you could write a book about this. It became you have to write a book about this. And I thank you.
Well, thank you. And I'm just struck by, you know, your desire to give your family a gift and answer some questions and bring some closure is providing a gift to so many other families. And I'm sure the Shabilsky family is one that's going to feel that same way. Was it the letter that your uncle wrote about the Linz mission that kind of turned you on to that as the focal point of the book?
No, he mentions it very briefly. He wrote a letter to his parents, and it says, "Did I ever tell you about the Linz mission, the last mission to Linz?" And then he says that some of the men, some of the rookies, were stopping by his tent afterwards to congratulate him. He had been the lead bombardier for his squadron that day, and they clobbered the target. That's the only time he speaks of combat at all in any of the letters. But that's not why. The reason I focused on Linz was because not only the Hitler connection, but as I researched that specific mission on April 25th, I did find some things on the internet, you know, men who had written about it in bomb group association newsletters or whatnot. The accounts were always the same. It was a horrible mission. The sky was black with exploding clouds of shrapnel, and the men got shot to pieces. That was enough for me to at least start down the path. And then once I found your show and some other pieces, it was clear that I had to do this.
Well, let's listen to some of that show Mike's talking about, recorded Memorial Day weekend in 2010 in Mesa, Arizona, with Dale Shabilsky, who actually would have already been heading home with his required 35 missions complete if not for a twist of fate.
My regular crew had finished But because I had to take time out to learn the radar, I was behind in the missions with them.
Now, in 33 missions, I imagine that 33rd wasn't the first time you encountered flak or enemy fire. How often did that occur, and did you have some close calls before that final mission?
Yes, one time we had been over Auschwitz in Poland, and we had two engines knocked out, and we got a citation. We made the trip all the way back from Auschwitz in Poland to Italy on two engines without jettisoning anything. As a result of that, we got a recognition for not jettisoning and making the longest mission recorded on B-24 with two engines.
So you must have had a pretty hot shot pilot or some divine intervention or something, huh?
Some of both. We did lose altitude, and we were fortunate that there was a P-51 that tucked itself up underneath our right wing. He flew with us as long as he could, and then he had to peel off because of air fuel. And we made it on. By the time we got to Italy, we was only about 9,000 feet off the ground.
Wow. And I imagine when you did touch those wheels down, there's a pretty big sense of relief or maybe applause throughout the plane or what?
I was shooting flares out of the top of the plane so that the ground crew would be alerted to the fact that we didn't know if our wheels would collapse when we hit or not. But fortunately, everything gave us a smooth landing and none of us were hurt.
Think there are a few prayers said in those moments?
Definitely. I know I did.
I'm not surprised. And when you survive a situation like that, do you say, okay, I've been through that, maybe we can get through anything? Or do you say, wow, that was crazy. One of these days, we're not going to make it back that way.
I never had a negative thought. I was ready to go whenever I needed to go. I did a lot of praying.
Well, and someone did a lot of answering because you're here talking to me today. That 33rd mission, what were you guys supposed to do that day? What went wrong, and how did you become a prisoner?
The Germans at that time were pulling back. We were out after another marshalling yard in Linz, Austria. Well, when we entered, I could tell that they were throwing everything up that they could. And there's three different kinds of flak, the regular flak, a red flak, and a white flak. Well, a white flak is a phosphorus flak. When it hit the airplane sides, it just eats the skin off the airplane. We had two engines knocked out over the target and one after that. You don't fly a B-24 on one engine. So we took a quick boat. We had a boat to either parachute out right then or try to crash land. So we've all voted for crash land because we'd heard too many stories about parachuting.
What kind of stories had you heard?
The people on the ground were meeting us with pitchforks and just killing us right there on the way down. Well, we were down to about 5,000 feet, and we just couldn't hold the ground. We ended up in Gwara, Hungary, and I can't tell you how far that is from Linz, Austria, but we crash-landed in Gwara, Hungary.
What was that like? I imagine if you were scared the first time when you're shooting out the flares, this is taking it to another level, right?
That's right. I had been hit over the eye, over my right eye and in my seat. Our tail gunner got hit in both knees, and he was unable to get out of the turret without help. So, yeah, there was a lot of panic. Our ball turret gunner, he could not bring the ball turret back up, so they had to help pull him up out of there. And needless to say, our intercom system was gone wild. We had to tell people, cool, so you can get messages from the pilot and myself. Part of my responsibilities was to detonate the radar equipment to burn it up. And the bomb site, we had to detonate it, burn it up.
Because you didn't want the Germans seeing what technology you had.
That's right. And also, all the radio equipment had to be detonated and burned up. So that was my job, and it kept me pretty busy until we hit.
And what was it like when you hit? I can't imagine it was the smoothest landing you had experienced.
No, it was like a hitting up against a brick wall, and it was just a sudden stop. And as soon as we did, we saw all these civilian people coming out, rushing towards us. And your first thought is, goodbye. They weren't. They were friendly.
Well, it's a good thing they were. So here you are, you're wounded in a couple different spots. You've just hit a brick wall, as you described it, in the crash landing. You think you're going to die, but these folks are actually friendly. What happens to you from there?
We were flying a 13-man crew, and the 11 of them went one way, that none of them were wounded. I learned later on that they had gotten back to the base within 2 days. The tail turret gunner we had to leave behind because both knees were completely shot out. So he was left with the Germans. And later on, I found out that he also did a lot better than I did, that they replaced both of his knees. The Germans Wow. replaced both of his knees. He had steak and lamb and all that to eat. I had to go a different way. And to this day, I swear I went to some kind of a church basement. And a man came in, and he took 22 stitches over my eye. He cleaned out as much of the flak out of my seat as he could. And after that, the five men from the local underground says, "We need to take you on. We can't keep you here because the Germans are on their way in." So anyhow, we walked from Gwyer, Hungary to Budapest, Hungary. At Budapest, Hungary, I gave myself up to what I thought was our allies, the Russians. As I approached, it was a big pond, and there was these soldiers all around it. And I go in with my hands up saying, "Amerikansky, Amerikansky." Well, that didn't register. Underground felt like I should do away with my uniform. So they burned it and gave me civilian clothes to wear. Well, anyhow, when I got there, the only thing I could surmise is that the Russians felt like I was German, because I was in civilian clothes, a blonde, blue-eyed, and I had Army 45, which they took, my dog tags they took, because they just said, well, that, you know, I got them from somebody else. And the only thing I had that was GI was my shorts, undershorts.
So at that point, you're wishing you had your uniform back.
Yeah. They stripped me down to my shorts, tied my hands behind my back, and pointed to a building which was about 2 football fields away. And it was a cobble field. Well, being barefooted and your hands tied in your back, you don't do too good, especially when they try to run you. And I'd fall down, they'd come along, they'd kick me, and they'd hit me with the butts of their guns. By the time I got to the building, I had 4 teeth broken out, a busted nose, 3 ribs, 5 toes, oh, and the wound over my eye opened again. And I was a mess by the time I got there.
What a nightmare. And you told me you never had a negative thought the entire time. How do you not have a negative thought in that situation? That's horrible.
At that time, all you're thinking is pray. So, and anyhow, we got to the building, and they just made me take a shower. Well, I thought, gee, I've read about this shower, you know, where it's poison to come down on you. Well, it wasn't. It was a real nice, hot, cold shower. And the idea was to wash the blood off of me. Well, all they did is let the water come down. My hands were still tied, so I couldn't do anything more. After they decided I was under the shower long enough, they pulled me out, went to this building and in a room, and they had a stool or a bench. They had me get up on the bench, untied my hands from the back of me, and tied me up on a beam with my hands over my head. But there was 2 women and 3 men come in, and they just started talking. I couldn't understand them, and they couldn't understand me. I kept saying, "American consulate, American consulate." And anyhow, that didn't work too well. And finally, they brought in a officer. At least that's what I assumed. And he could talk broken English. And he had told me that if I didn't tell them the truth and what they wanted to know, that I would not see tomorrow. And he pointed to a woman, and he said, "She will get the truth out of you." Well, what they did, they put a bunch of electric electrodes on you. Mm-hmm. And it must have been a low current, because when they activated it, my whole body, you just lose control of everything. They'd leave it on, I'd pass out, they'd wake me up, turn it on again. And I don't know how many times this occurred, but I finally decided I'm going to make up a story. And I said, there's 10,000 airplanes ready to come over to you, and you better be ready. That did not go over good. So I said, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it was 100. That went over all right. Then they were saying something else, this woman, and I couldn't understand her. And so she got real mad at me, and she had a rifle, and she came to the back of me and just really beat me up in my back. Came back in front and stuck the rifle or the barrel of the gun right in my face. Well, I still couldn't understand her. All I could say is American consulate. So it ended up that this man said, okay, we're going to leave you here overnight and let you think about it. And when we come back, you better be ready to tell us. Well, again, I don't know how long, but I know I was there long enough where I no longer had any feeling in my arms. It was just completely, you know, like they were dead. And they had turned out the lights, so it was pure dark in there. And whenever they came back, they showered me with water, woke me up, and again, I couldn't feel anything. And I thought, well, go ahead and kill me. You know, what have I got to lose? And they decided that I was telling them everything I could. Well, when they let me down on the floor, I just collapsed. And they drugged me out of there. And I don't know how. They put me in like what I call a closet, because it wasn't long enough for me to lay down and stretch out, but I could curl up. And they kept me in there. Then they came and got me and tried to interrogate me again. Of course, I was too weak to say anything. They take me back, and all I had to in there with me was a bucket. And once a day, I had a tin can full of some kind of liquid and green stuff, once a day. That went on for a period of time. I kept saying American consulate, American consulate. And finally, the war was over. Finally got an audience with American consulate. Well, they interviewed me, and they said, well, it's going to take about a week to 10 days to verify that what you said is true, because they check your family and all that kind of stuff. Well, they did come back, but on the interim time, the one officer said that if I said anything about how I was treated, I wouldn't see tomorrow. And he said, I'll be there when you talk to him. And you say one thing out of line, you're dead. So when they came back, they interviewed me, and they said, yeah, we're going to set you out for free. And this was 30 days at least after I'd been, longer than that, about 2.5 months, that all this transpired. And finally I got to, they freed me. The soldier that was there wished me luck. They had a banquet for me. They had a big roast pig on the table. Full pig, and they had poured me a goblet full of what I thought was water. I didn't know any better, and man, having not had any water for so long, I bottomed up. Well, I passed out.
Vodka.
I truthfully don't know how long I was passed out, but when I woke up, I was back in this little closet room, and I finally woke up. And I knocked on the door until somebody came. And they finally gave me some clothes that I could put on. They were kind of big. Anyhow, we had the banquet again. I don't know if it was the same roast pig or not. But anyhow, there was another roast pig. And this time they poured me this glass. And accidentally, on purpose, I hit it and it fell on the floor. Well, I never drank anymore. Because I was a guest of honor, I got the first slice off the pig. Well, it was 100 total fat. Well, I thought to myself, I can't eat that. I haven't had any food for 6 months. So somehow that slipped off on the floor. And I got a piece of ham later and some vegetables. And about a week after that banquet, the American people arranged for me to go down to the seaport in Kiev. I got on this English ship We went from Kiev all over the Black Sea back to Italy. Well, when I got back to the base was deactivated. There was a dentist apprentice and a couple of the base commander and a couple others in one tent. Well, I came down with malaria. And they did the best they could for me then. And the colonel said, well, do you think you'd be ready to fly in about a week? I said, as far as I'm concerned, I'm ready to go now. So anyhow, after about a week, we did fly, and we went back to the States. My folks had been told early that I was missing in action, and then they came and said I was KIA, and they paid them the $10,000. And, of course, none of this I knew about. So anyhow, when I got back to the States, I called home, you know. Well, my brother answered the phone, and he said, who is this? And I said, Jack, you dummy, I'm your brother, Dale. And he said, you're dead. We told you you're dead. Well, all I can say is that the good Lord blessed me. And being younger than that, I guess that you can survive some of those things. I didn't think I would.
The late Dale Shabilsky, a central figure in the new book, Bombing Hitler's Hometown by Mike Croissant. Learn all about it online at MikeCroissant.com or link to it at HometownHeroesRadio.com. And we'll hear more from the author when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.